Happy to be joined by our good friend, Michael Grange. Hello, Michael. Long time no talk.
Hey, guys. How are you?
I'm doing very well. So, yeah, this is a ridiculous start for the Toronto Raptors. So much of it looks sustainable. If I was going to point to one thing, I guess, that didn't, I would be on alert for maybe a regression, it would be the Serge Ibaka start, who's hit, what, like 25 of his last 28s? Is this the new Serge now?
I don't think he's going to continue 87% field goal efficiency or whatever he's been the last little while.
Hater.
No,
you're a hater.
I'm a hater. But I think even before he went on this hot streak, I remember I was looking up sort of during the, you know, the crazy game in Utah, and I think he was already at a career high in two-point percentage. Like, he's around 60 or 61% from two. And so I think, you know, so I think obviously they've kind of hit on a new way of playing, a little bit different way of playing for him as it relates to him. And he's, you know, they've found a way for him to be very comfortable. You know, without talking to Serge in depth about this, I bet you he's been through a couple of transitions, right? I think in Oklahoma City, you know, he probably was really trying to push the boundaries of his game and thought he was sort of needed to be on par with Westbrook and Durant to an extent. And I think, you know, that was part of the idea of him going to Orlando, was that he'd be a bigger offensive cog. And then the three-point shooting kind of really took, you know, a front seat. And, you know, now that, I wouldn't say that was an experiment, but I think he's kind of probably been open to the fact of, you know what, this is how I'm most effective. Occasionally shooting threes, spotting up when they're there, pick and pop as kind of an option. But, you know, getting into as many one-on-one or one-on-none matchups as I possibly can in and around the paint and use my touch to score. And I think that's probably a lot of credit to Nick to kind of recognizing that, a lot of credit to Serge to go, you know what, this is where I should be at this point in my career, and obviously it's worked great.
Yeah, I was going to say, it feels like, obviously the player has to get a lot of credit because he's the one that's doing it, but if there's one thing that Nick Nurse, I would say, the most notable change he's made to the coaching staff other than having Kawhi Leonard and Danny Green at his disposal is, yeah, that he seems to have figured out the more efficient way to use Serge Ibaka, and that having him more in pick-and-roll sets and having him touch the ball a little bit more frequently closer to the basket and not having him kind of just stand out there on the wing and wait and then force his offense has probably been, how would you weight that in terms of Nick's accomplishments so far? Because I would say it's number one.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's and that happened by splitting JV and Serge and kind of going with a four out type format with both lineups, which is, so what they did last year with the bench mob, basically the whole team is playing like the bunch mob did last year, with the exception of you know, I think they're still trying to fully maximize Kawhi Leonard in that scenario. But when, you know, but I think you're exactly right. I think being able to split those guys, getting them to buy into it, getting each of them to do what they're sort of best at and not have an adjustment in terms of, you know, kind of sulking or feeling like they're missing out or anything like that, I think has been tremendous. And I've said this before, I'm sure we've talked about it, is, you know, Jonas Valanciunas deserves a huge amount of credit because I think he'd only started six times in his career and been a very, very productive, very, very consistent player and, you know, has kind of really become mostly the backup center, and his minutes are down and yet his production is up. So I think the combination of those two things is really been a big story. And credit to Nick, but credit to those two guys too.
Yeah, and I also would like to just quickly say, I don't think that this is any disparagement of Casey because the roster was so different. And they did have Jakob Poeltl, right? And bench mob was so effective. So I do kind of look at it and think, well, what was he supposed to do with the roster construction he had? It would have been a little bit more difficult. And they did try Serge at the five in the postseason, and it wasn't.
And they were the number two ranked offense in the NBA
right.
last.
Exactly. So,
like they were better than they were statistically better than Golden State.
Right.
So they did win 59 games. You know, I did look. I looked back today, just where was this team at the same time, this start is definitely better than last year. There's no secret there. But it almost, they were 7-5 after 12 games last year, and we can't ignore the fact that they went 52-18 after that.
Yeah.
Like, so, you know, the Like, they've had really, really, really good regular seasons before, as soon as last year. And, you know, hopefully what they, the way they're going to get to their 59 or 60 or whatever wins they end up at this year ends up being a little more sustainable in the playoffs.
Well, and if you remember last year, they started off with a similar road trip, but it was a little bit more difficult. Like, they had that game against Golden State that came down to the wire. And,
they had a six-game trip, and it was tough. So, so anyway, like I agree with you. I mean, I think you know, I don't think there may have been a more ideal way to configure that lineup last year. But, you know, we're talking degrees of, like, a very small degree of better, right? And who knows that the players would have, you know, with Serge's open last to changing his usage patterns, had he not been coming off a really, really tough year and a terrible playoff. Like, I mean, you're never going to get a guy more open to change than after a situation like that, I would expect.
So, and again, not to disparage those who were here before them, and yes, they were super effective, but I wonder if some of what we're seeing with Kyle Lowry is just that not having DeMar DeRozan as a guy who needs to touch the basketball a ton in your offense is actually what's unlocking this version of Kyle Lowry.
Well, I've asked Kyle Lowry twice directly why your assist number's up, and twice he said, I don't have to pass to Debo. So, part of that is him kind of being funny, right? Like, you know, the best player I've ever, you know, my best friend was kind of holding me down as we both, you know, made all-star teams and won games, et cetera. But part of it is, you know, there's truth in it, right? Like when, you know, DeMar DeRozan initiated a lot of offense, and he also once, you know, he was the focus of an offense, you know, he would finish the play, and so there wasn't as much touches. And even when you are like Kawhi Leonard is a fairly high usage rate, and he is proving to be a fairly very good isolation player, but he does play in isolation a lot. But he's quicker in it, so you know. So I think there's even more assists when you that way. But I think generally there's more movement, more transition, more running, and you know, and that's a big and more room. And that's a big reason why Kyle's assist numbers are up.
So, Kawhi has been a very isolation-oriented offensive player. I just expect that to change as he gets more comfortable in the offense and everybody gets more comfortable around each other. Is it obvious? Is that necessarily 100% going to happen?
I'm not sure. I mean, if you look at his best year offensively, you know, the year before last in San Antonio, his usage numbers were really high. They were right at or maybe even higher what we've seen from DeMar the last few years. And, you know, he was incredibly successful at it, and he's been incredibly successful in it. Like, usually the knock against isolation basketball is, you know, not to pick on my buddy Kobe Bryant, but it ends up being very inefficient because you're, by definition, taking a lot of contested shots, and other guys don't necessarily participate as much, and so their efficiency goes down. So, you know, we haven't seen that. Like, Kawhi Leonard is a really good isolation player. He's a high efficiency player, and I thought his willingness to take on that role doesn't seem to be at the detriment of other guys as much, or if at all. And I think there is an argument that, you know, there is moments in big games where if you have a guy who can get you buckets after late in clock when things break down, it's a very handy tool to have. It can be often be the difference in games.
So he's DeMar. I was going to say he's DeMar DeRozan with a three-point shot.
You know, I would have to kind of layer them over one or the other. But I don't see a vast difference in how the two guys score, other than Kawhi Leonard is a much, much better 3-point shooter. So that alone creates more space and more room. I do think in his isolation play, he gets into his shots a little. And this is totally eye test. So, you know, I'm happy to be proven wrong, but I think he gets into his shots a little quicker, like a little less off the dribble. It's more like a two dribble to a spot, and then he's got a bigger body so he can kind of lean and create his space and get his shot. He knows where his spots are. So, you know, like, they're different animals, they're different athletes. But I think offensively their impact is quite similar, I would say.
Yeah, and I think as
defensively, the guy is a complete game changer, right? Like, he's, you know, it's not only what he does defensively, it's what he kind of demands everyone else do just because of what he's doing. And that, if you know, that, you know, I think if you still had DeMar DeRozan offensively, sure, you'd like to have the three-point shooting, but, you know, like Kawhi Leonard's defense is probably the biggest single difference, potential difference in this team.
Yeah, and I don't even think that Kawhi is all the way engaged in his defense so far. Like, I think he's just getting by with a lot of skill. Yeah, exactly. And there are moments in every game where he's just kind of like, yeah, you know, I don't need to dig in, or I'm not even defending the team's best player all the time because they have Siakam, they have OG Anunoby, and they also have Danny Green. We don't need to get caught up in comparing DeRozan and Kawhi all season long, and I think we've already kind of moved on from some of this. But I would say that if Kawhi could, if he could absorb anything from DeMar, though, at some point it would be the focus on facilitating a little bit more. And like, yeah, when you say we see a lot of that isolation stuff, like, of course. And even though it is a more efficient isolation and one that does involve more three-point shooting and especially more threatening three-point shooting, I still think that the key for this Raptors team, I was saying before you come on, is for Kawhi to be watching these games when he's out of the lineup and see what Pascal Siakam is able to do in his absence and look at the players around him and say, okay, clearly they're successful without me because some other guys are stepping up, and how can I, when I'm playing with guys, unlock them a little bit better? Because to me, yesterday I thought it was interesting that there was a couple of moments where, I think it was at the end of the second quarter or the start of the second quarter and in the fourth, where they went with OG playing with Kawhi, and it works better because OG is better off the ball right now. And when Siakam came in, it's very much like Siakam gets his turn to be on offense rather than he's incorporated in something that they're doing as a team. And that the two of those guys haven't really figured out how to play with each other, or Kawhi, it's going to take some time for him to figure out how to get the best out of Siakam.
Yeah, or Siakam to get the best out of Kawhi, right? Like, I mean, you know, we just don't know all the combinations and how they're all going to settle in. You know, I thought it was interesting that on that trip last night and against Utah, I wasn't at the game last night. I was watching it. I'm back in Toronto. Some of the most effective basketball they played was all of a sudden you had Kyle Lowry setting ball screens for Pascal Siakam, right? And you know, just because Siakam's such a dangerous ball handler and you kind of clear out and Kyle drags the man with him because of his three-point shooting, and all of a sudden he attacks. And so there's all kinds of potential there. And, does that mean, you know, Pascal Siakam takes more ball handling, playmaking responsibilities when he's on the floor with Kawhi Leonard? You know, maybe. Does that mean that, you know, it maybe isn't a bad thing that Siakam does more than one thing alongside Kawhi Leonard? I mean, but I think we could all agree there is a lot more, meat on this bone in terms of how they can maximize all the tools they have. And that's, you know, they're 11-1. They're like number 3 or 4 in net rating. Their net rating is significantly higher than it was last year when they were, you know, the second best team in basketball regular season. And I think if we were to sit down and go, of these 12 games, how many have they played really well? Like where you just said, yeah, this is, I mean, there's been stretches in many of the games, but I wouldn't say there's been, I don't even know if there's been one game where I've said, this is how good this team can be. And I think if you're the rest of the league, you got to be pretty worried about that.
Oh yeah, you got to be terrified. You should be. Who has a higher ceiling, OG or Pascal?
Oh, that's funny. That's,
you didn't have one in the holster for that one.
I'm
surprised.
I was actually talking about this with my son the other day, and it was inconclusive. You know, like I think OG Anunoby is going to be an all NBA first team defender. I don't know if it'll be this year, but it'll be soon, and he'll be a fixture. He's just going to be one of those guys who just absolutely swallows other teams and ruins game plans, and he's going to be like that cornerback that you can't throw to. You know, I don't know if he'll ever be. I think he's going to be a really good three-point shooter. You know, so I guess what I'm saying is he's going to be an elite 3-and-D power forward. You know, I don't know if he'll ever be quite the dynamic playmaker than Siakam is. And then defensively, Siakam, I think, is going to be really, really good. He is really, really good. But will he ever have that, you know, that kind of brute force that OG Anunoby has coupled with his intelligence to just wreak havoc on whoever's across from defensively? So, you know, they're both going to be really good. You know, and I think they're going to be different. I couldn't say which one is going to be better.
Fence setter.
I think the good thing is that you have those two guys.
It's a luxury, man. It is a luxury.
We have talked about Jamal Murray in the past. I remember you were on the podcast a couple months ago, and we talked about whether he has taken the torch from Andrew Wiggins as the number one Canadian, and even if it's just a placeholder status because RJ Barrett's coming up. And I think that at this point it's pretty clear. Like, I'm watching the Timberwolves last night, and Andrew Wiggins, whenever he takes a shot, it feels like it's a win for the defense, and he just seems like a largely irrelevant player at this point, to be honest. And Jamal Murray scoring 48 points the other night and gets embroiled in a controversy, but made me think of this, and I was curious to get your thought on it. Is Jamal Murray the first Canadian lottery pick that's going to reach his potential since Steve Nash?
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. I mean, you know, it's kind of like the story that's not as much fun to talk about is of the Canadians that have gone in the lottery. You know, Tristan Thompson's had a really good career. Probably not commensurate with being a four pick, but I mean, he's going to be a 12-year NBA vet with rings. Like, I mean, you know, it's hard to nitpick at that. You know, but you go on down the list, and there's a lot of guys you haven't quite, you know, haven't really materialized. And then you have guys like Dwight Powell, a second round pick, who's worked out really well. But Jamal Murray, I think, is going to be, you know, 5-10 years from now, yeah, he was a seventh pick. He was a good pick. He was an elite player on good teams. He'll probably end up being a really good role player on great teams one day. And a lot of it stems from exactly what we saw the other night. The guy's just got a giant set of cojones, always has, absolutely fearless. And so whatever attributes, abilities he has, you know, he's never going to get lost in his own head. Not that guy, right? So,
yeah.
So, I mean, he's a good story. But I think, in a way, it's like that is, there is a wave coming on here, right? Where, because I think it took a while for Canadians to get recognized at all. I think about a bunch of guys made it in the league and still didn't quite, you know, weren't able to quite realize what they had, chances, the opportunity they had. And now you have guys, this next generation guys are like reaching there with a sense of entitlement, right? Like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is going to be a really, really, really good player. Like, I don't know if he'll be an all-star, but he's going to be as important a player as Jamal Murray, I'm sure. I don't think anyone's predicting RJ Barrett will somehow be a bust. Like, he's about as sure pick as you could ever have in the top one, two, or three, wherever he goes. And that will set the new standard, right? Like, that's what a Canadian lottery pick will look like. And it's only going to get better.
Yeah, I was looking at his draft class, and I think that there's a pretty strong case that you would take Jamal Murray third. Like, that you would go Ben Simmons 1, Jaylen Brown 2, and then it would be a debate between whether you like him more than Brandon Ingram. And it's like, it just seems crazy that guys like Dragan Bender and Chris Dunn at the time went ahead of him, because it's like, yeah, no.
What year was that?
That was 2016. That's the Ben Simmons draft.
2016.
Yes.
Yeah, no, the more you look back at these drafts, the more you realize that crowdsourcing your lottery picks is probably the best, most efficient way for NBA teams to go.
Yeah, sexy blogger picks turn out.
No, except for that's how Stauskas got picked by the Kings.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Well, and we should point out, you know, like Stauskas isn't going to, like, that draft, that 14 draft, which Stauskas is in, you take a close look at that, it is the most messed up draft ever. The best players are all taken in the second round, almost, it seems. A lot of credit to Nick. I mean, he's seeming to have found some traction in Portland.
Yeah.
And if we're going to talk Canadian basketball, I can make the case that he's almost the linchpin for where Canada can go as a medal contender in the next 2 to 6 years, because his ability to shoot and playmake at that level at his size is going to be essential.
I'll always blame Boogie Cousins for delaying his development. Like, that first year in Sacramento, whenever Stauskas took a shot, and if he missed, it was just Boogie Cousins staring him down the entire way down the floor. I was like, well, this isn't very good. This doesn't seem like a great situation for him.
But, I mean, that story, and it's not just Nick, it happens to a lot of guys, is, you know, you make the NBA, and you're fighting every day. You know, the mental toughness it requires to be selfish enough to stick to your game and execute until you get to the point where your teammates are all good with it. And it's harder on some teams than others, right? Like, that's why, like, the Steve Nash effect was real, right? Like, he just made guys comfortable sooner. And you get in some environments where there's not that kind of, you got the Boogie Cousins effect, I guess. And, you know, the trying to fight through that is part of being a pro. And I think Nick struggled with it. And he had chances, interestingly, in Brooklyn. I thought that was a great environment. Didn't work out. Philly could have been a great environment. Didn't work out. So, you know, he's really on his last shot here. But, you know, he's you know, hopefully it's the right environment for him because he is a very talented player.
Yeah, so far so good. Shooting 42% on 3.6 three-pointers a game.
Hey, here's the thing. Shooters with chances or shooters with size get chances. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I'm not surprised that he's continued to get them.
It's a good point. Grange, thanks as always.
See you, buddy.
Thanks, guys.